But he was also he's also the brother-in-law of the chairman of the PROMESA board, the financial control board that is running Puerto Rico. His he had a law firm that was representing that was doing work for the PROMESA board, and he also was a lobbyist for AES Corporation, a Virginia-based company that was polluting Puerto Rico with coal ash from their plant in the southern part of Puerto Rico. So he's got all kinds of conflicts that make him unlikely to be supported by the majority of people to remain as interim governor.
Well, we'll continue to follow this and talk about it tomorrow on Democracy Now! To see all our coverage of Puerto Rico, visit democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkting, Gesder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tommy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alcock, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masu, Trina Nair, K. Maria Studio, and Maria Torres-Singer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki Memorial 2019 on Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza in Portland. This year, the annual Hiroshima Nagasaki Memorial event is focused on the unequal impacts of nuclear weapons and will explore the disproportionate impacts that nuclear weapons have on women, children, indigenous communities, and communities of color. Again, that's Hiroshima and Nagasaki Memorial 2019, the unequal impacts of nuclear weapons, on Tuesday, August 6th at 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good afternoon. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Taj Mahal with Mark Cohn featuring guest vocalist Blind Boys of Alabama, Friday, August 16th. All ages welcome. Tickets and more information available online at zooconcerts.com. It's 5:02, time for your KBOO evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ACLU is suing the city of Portland on behalf of an injured protester.
A new lawsuit details decades of abuse within the Boy Scouts of America.
And renowned American novelist, essayist, editor, and teacher Toni Morrison has passed away from complications of pneumonia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 6th, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. The American Civil Liberties Union is being sued by the city of Portland. The American Civil Liberties Union is suing the city of Portland on behalf of a peaceful protester that was injured last year. Michelle Fawcett was allegedly struck in the chest and arm by a flashbang grenade while taking part in a protest on August 4th, 2018. In the lawsuit filed in Multnomah County Circuit Court, the ACLU is seeking $250,000 on her behalf and argues that Portland City Hall is liable for the injuries. Jan Carson, interim executive director for the ACLU's local branch, said at a press conference that the use of military-grade munitions by the Portland Police Bureau constituted excessive force. Carson said, quote, "These deadly weapons are meant to be shot overhead, but the police instead fired them directly into groups of innocent people." On the day in question, August 4th, 2018, officers in riot gear used batons, pepper spray, flashbangs, and rubber bullets to clear Southwest Columbia Street. The protesters were blocked by a skirmish line at Naito Parkway from confronting a group of conservative Patriot supporters who were unharmed during the resulting action. Police Chief Danielle Outlaw faced intense scrutiny for using crowd control tactics on only one side. The ACLU claims that Fawcett suffered permanent injuries, including third-degree chemical burns, soft tissue damage, impact wounds, mental and emotional distress, depression, and nightmares. Reading from prepared remarks during a press conference, Fawcett said, quote, "I felt that it was my duty to stand against violence, bigotry, and hatred in our community. My recovery has been slow and painful. I no longer feel safe in my community." The ACLU added that this suit is one of eight to be filed on behalf of protesters in Portland who were allegedly injured or unlawfully detained by police.
Governor Kate Brown announced on Sunday that she is considering using her veto power to kill various proposals brought by rural lawmakers of both parties. Her staff added that the veto threat is not political revenge, but rather sincere concern about legislation passed in the 2019 session. Brown is considering axing policies that would make it easier to remove and fill ground from wetlands, move forward on the retrofit of two dams in Newport, and provide money to help eastern Oregon counties plan larger urban growth boundaries. Brown's deadline to veto is Friday, August 9th, and she has to give 5 days' notice before making the decision. So far, Brown has not vetoed anything from the 2019 session. House Bill 2437 would increase the amount of material commercial developers can remove from a wetland without a permit by 60 times what is now allowed. It would also increase the amount of dredged material that can be dumped in a wetland without a permit. Brown's announcement was cheered by the environmental group Waterwatch. Additionally, Brown is considering vetoing money for local projects approved by the legislature, such as replacing the two dams on Big Creek in Newport. Brown is also considering revoking $500,000 appropriated to the Association of Oregon Counties for Urban Growth by boundary planning grants for Eastern Oregon. Finally, the governor is also considering stopping a $5 million transfer in fee revenue from the Oregon Medical Board to the general fund.
A former Aloha High School teacher who was accused last year of downloading child pornography using school district Wi-Fi was found guilty on Monday in Washington County Court. 40-year-old Jeffrey Germano was convicted on 7 counts of first-degree encouraging child sex abuse. Germano had been a special education teacher at Aloha High School since 2009 and previously taught at Highland Park Middle School in Beaverton from 2006 to 2009. In April of 2018, the Washington County Sheriff's Office began investigating Germano's online activity after finding 3 IP addresses connected to his home and the Beaverton School District linked to 73 child pornography files downloaded over a period of 2 years. Germano was placed on paid administrative leave on May 2nd, and investigators received a warrant to search his home. In law enforcement interviews, Germano admitted to downloading child pornography on his personal laptop. He also told investigators he had brought the laptop to school, but did not intentionally use the school's Wi-Fi to download pornography. Germano quit his job with the Beaverton School District on September 20th and was arrested less than 1 month later. Germano is scheduled to be sentenced on August 22nd, and according to the Washington County District Attorney's Office, he will remain out of custody until he is sentenced.
A new lawsuit alleges that the Boy Scouts of America failed to stop hundreds of previously unreported sexual predators. A group of lawyers is claiming to have uncovered hundreds of previously unreported cases of sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts, according to a lawsuit filed Monday in Pennsylvania. The plaintiff in the case, named only as SD to keep his identity private, is alleging that he was assaulted hundreds of times by a scout leader in Pennsylvania over the course of about 4 years in the 1970s. The lawsuit goes even further, alleging that the abuse would not have been possible had it not been for the negligence of the Boy Scouts, that the organization conspired to keep incidents of sexual assault a secret, and that the organization and other defendants engaged in reckless misconduct in failing to protect its young participants. The litigation comes from an effort to unearth previously unreported cases of child sexual abuse in one of the country's most prominent youth organizations. The lawsuit is spearheaded by the group Abused in Scouting, a coalition of law firms that collaborate on bringing such cases to light. The complaint, which was filed on Monday in Philadelphia's Court of Common Pleas, names the Boy Scouts of America, the Penn Mountains Council, and the alleged abuser as defendants.
The U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman, has submitted his resignation letter. Huntsman's resignation is effective October 3rd, and there's speculation that he is planning to run for governor of Utah. Huntsman previously served as governor of the state from 2005 to 2009. His resignation comes just as the Trump administration is also dealing with the departure of Fiona Hill, the top official on Russia affairs at the National Security Council. Hill is expected to leave her position later this month, meaning the administration will need to replace two of its top officials on Russian affairs at the same time.
Now it's time for the daily national newscast from the Public News Service. The Public News Service has bureaus in 36 states dedicated to news in the public interest.
The Public News Service daily newscast for Tuesday, August 6, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. A former president speaks out against rhetoric that fuels fear and hatred. Also on our Tuesday rundown, is the migrant crisis stoking racial conflict? Plus, folks in New Hampshire tell their governor, give back his raise or give them one too. First, our top story, former President Barack Obama Monday called for action in response to back-to-back mass shootings over this weekend, urging Americans to soundly reject leaders who feed a climate of fear and hatred. That from The Hill. The Hill reports the former president issued a lengthy statement after more than 30 people were killed in mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. Quoting Obama, we should soundly reject language coming out of the mouths of any of our leaders that feeds a climate of fear and hatred and also normalizes racial sentiments. He added leaders who demonize those who don't look like us or refer to other people as subhuman or imply that America belongs to just one certain type of people. Meantime, close observers of the El Paso border accused the Trump administration of manipulating migrant policy to create a crisis with tragic results. Dan Hyman reports for Public News Service.
Fernando Garcia with the Border Network for Human Rights has been close to the issues for 20 years. He says more people have sought asylum in past years, but Garcia says the difference now is that Trump is intentionally creating a racially charged conflict for political ends. He says if the administration were really worried about the buildup at the border, the obvious thing would have been to hire more asylum officers and immigration court judges to speed up deportation or asylum.
That didn't happen. The administration saw an opportunity to actually create what I believe this administration it is good at, to create chaos, to make it appear as a crisis.
Trump regularly describes the migrants as an invasion made up of criminals, with the migrants backing up in camps awaiting processing. The pictures reinforce that. But that view of America under siege also showed up in the writings of the shooter in this weekend's El Paso shooting. Federal immigration agencies have not replied to emailed questions by deadline, but Garcia points out that the White House sees no problem requesting funds for a border wall.
He got billions of dollars for infrastructure. So there's no way that they don't have money to feed children or to have more asylum officers.
Several studies have shown immigrants actually create more jobs than they take. Other research has argued they can help save Social Security as well as Medicare by paying in more than they take out. And now to North Dakota and Eric Tegedoff. A new report assesses how the state is doing when it comes to preventing cancer.
The 17th edition of How Do You Measure Up? From the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network looks at state legislative activity and gauges how lawmakers are supporting policies that reduce cancer. It says the Peace Garden State improved people's lives by expanding Medicaid. Deb Knuth is North Dakota Government Relations Director with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network.
There is some polling out there showing that the states that have Medicaid expansion, such as North Dakota, they're seeing an improvement in the citizens' lives, ability to go back to work, perhaps, and certainly the quality of life has improved.
According to the report, about 2.3 million people with a history of cancer rely on Medicaid. It also says North Dakota has good laws on the books banning smoking in public places and that its tobacco prevention program is well-funded.
And one community health center in eastern Kentucky, reflecting now on 14 years serving rural residents regardless of their ability to pay or their insurance status.
Karen Ditch runs Juniper Health, a community health center in Lee County, one of 24 federally funded health centers in the state. She says before her clinic in Beattyville opened, residents had to travel long distances to visit a doctor, dentist, or mental health specialist.
I can remember very vividly, and I can see it in my mind, people literally coming through the door and crying because they realized, number one, we're here to serve everybody that walks through our doors, regardless of their ability to pay, and that we had a sliding fee scale that was affordable to them, and that they could get, some of these folks in their 40s and 50s were receiving health care for the first time in their lives.
Finally, Gene Stanley reports activists from across the political spectrum are calling on Governor Chris Sununu to give back his raise and give one to Granite Staters instead.
Yesterday, advocates from an economy that works for everyone and volunteers from the New Hampshire Democratic Party presented the governor with a banner signed by 755 state residents calling on him to sign SB 10, which would establish a state minimum wage. Holly Shulman with the New Hampshire Democratic Party says some constituents are upset that he's taken two pay raises at taxpayers' expense without securing a living wage for the state's most vulnerable residents.
The signers include Republicans, they include independents, they include people from all over the state. We're looking at a wide spectrum of people who are really passionate about this issue. And what seems to be preventing Chris Sununu from taking action is deciding with corporate special interests, with big businesses, out-of-state corporations, at the expense of everyone else.
New Hampshire is the only New England state without a set minimum wage. Sununu has long said he opposes a state minimum wage, saying it should be set at the federal level.
According to a study by the Federal Reserve in Boston, 24% of kids in New Hampshire have one parent who makes less than $15 an hour. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and you'll find us online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now, it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. Coming up on today's episode, Cheyenne River Sioux tribal roads are unsafe after flooding. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is requesting a hearing on the Dakota Access Pipeline plan, and Yeselta del Sur Pueblo is offering assistance to shooting victims.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is seeking emergency funding to repair and replace roads on the Eagle Butte Reservation in South Dakota. The roads are managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Tribal officials say they're in dangerous conditions following widespread flooding connected to a man-made dam. China Lockett has more.
Washed out gravel roads, missing chunks of pavement, and potholes make navigating BIA Road 3 in Eagle Butte difficult. In some areas, culverts have 3-foot holes rusted into them, and the ground has fallen through, leaving deep holes in shoulders on the road, while some other BIA roads have culverts that have been entirely washed out of the ground. Tater Ward is a Cheyenne River Tribal Council representative. He says most culverts were put in about 50 years ago.
They don't really update them until they wash out, and then they come along and put a new one in. So that's been the norm, you know, around here because of the funding.
The tribe receives nearly $2.5 million in federal funding every year to fix their roads. Ward says that money doesn't go very far in Eagle Butte. This spring, water levels were high enough to flow over a nearly 20-foot high water bank and damage the roads.
This spring, they predicted it to be the highest it's ever been, 27 feet, I think.
Ward says there were 3 floods that caused hazardous situations where people had to be airlifted from their house or leave on horseback so they could get across the road. He says there were 2 deaths related to the condition of the roads after the flooding.
Tribes in our area, the Great Plains area, we have the same problems. We're underfunded and we don't get the money that we need and the maintenance that goes along with it. So we need help.
The tribe has applied for an emergency grant through the federal government to fix the roads before school starts and avoid dangerous situations for buses. They've been told not to fix the roads themselves until they have an answer. For National Native News, I'm Chyna Lockett in Rapid City.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is requesting North Dakota regulators hold a hearing on Energy Transfer's plan to expand capacity of the Dakota Access Pipeline. The tribe's concern plans to double oil will increase threats of a spill. Regulators asked for a formal request last month, the Associated Press reports. The Sierra Club is also reportedly filing a request. In June, the energy company announced plans to expand from more than 500,000 barrels per day to more than a million. The Hopi tribe in Arizona has taken over more law enforcement duties from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Emergency calls will go directly to the tribe instead of the BIA. The tribal council was split on the decision, the Associated Press reports, but the council recently voted for the takeover of patrol and administrative services. The Hopi reservation in northeastern Arizona is more than 2,500 square miles and is surrounded by the Navajo Nation. Isleta del Sur Pueblo in El Paso, Texas, announced Monday the tribe is donating more than $100,000 of assistance following the mass shooting in the city. The money will go to a community fund set up to help victims and their families. In addition, tribal leaders plan to donate all revenue from a country music concert this month to the community fund. Isleta del Sur Pueblo is a federally recognized tribe located about 13 miles from downtown El Paso. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Toni Morrison, a literary icon, passed away Monday night at Montefiore Medical Center in New York. She was 88 years old. Morrison's work explored Black identity in America, and in particular, the experience of Black women. Her death was announced by her publisher, Alfred A. Knopf. A spokesperson said the cause of death was complications of pneumonia. Morrison was the first African American woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature, which was awarded to her in 1993. Morrison was the author of 11 novels, as well as various children's books and essay collections. Among her most celebrated works are Song of Solomon, which received the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1977, and Beloved, which won both the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the American Book Award in 1988.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with a low of 63 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly cloudy in the morning, giving way to mainly sunny skies and a high of 86 degrees. Today in history, in 1945, the United States becomes the first and only nation to use atomic weaponry during wartime when it drops an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Approximately 80,000 people were killed as a direct result of the blast, and another 60,000 would die by the end of the year from the effects of the fallout. The quote of the day is from Toni Morrison, who said, "Language alone protects us from the scariness of things with no names. Language alone is meditation."
North Korea has accused the U.S. of, quote, inciting tension by holding joint military exercises with South Korea, adding that Pyongyang would take measures to defend itself. The North Korean government also warned that hostile moves against the nation, quote, have reached the danger line. Ju Young-chol, a North Korean diplomat in Geneva, told the UN-sponsored conference on disarmament that Pyongyang would have to reconsider the steps they had taken so far. He did not mention North Korea's latest firing of missiles into the sea off its east coast earlier on Tuesday. According to South Korean officials, North Korea fired missiles into the sea for the fourth time in less than 2 weeks. North Korean officials have said that they are committed to diplomacy and will wait until the end of the year for the U.S. to soften its policy of sanctions and political pressure over Pyongyang's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program.
The Trump administration has formally labeled China a currency manipulator after China's central bank allowed the yuan to fall in retaliation for new U.S. tariffs. This move further escalates the trade war between D.C. and Beijing. While the Treasury Department's determination is largely symbolic, it underscores how rapidly the relationship between the world's two largest economies is deteriorating. The move greatly affected financial markets, with the S&P 500 index futures sliding almost 2% at one point. China's currency broke the 7 per dollar level on Monday for the first time since 2008, causing ripples across global markets. The U.S. announcement followed a declaration by China's central bank chief, Yi Gang, that the nation would not use the yuan as a tool to influence trade disputes. Yi said in a statement, quote, "I am fully confident that the yuan will remain a strong currency in spite of recent fluctuations amid external uncertainties." This is the first time the U.S. has labeled a country a currency manipulator since the 1990s, when China was also the target. Officially, the designation requires the U.S. government to seek negotiations with the government accused of manipulation, often through the International Monetary Fund. However, officials in Beijing and D.C. have already been engaged in trade talks for more than a year. If there is still no progress a year after the designation, China could face possible sanctions, including its firms being prohibited from competition for U.S. government contracts and excluded from getting financing from an American government agency for development projects. However, a 2016 analysis shows that Chinese firms had marginal contracts over the past few years and had no such development financing outstanding. What could be more meaningful is that the designation increases the potential for outright currency intervention by the U.S. and further tariffs from the Commerce Department.
India's parliament has voted to reorganize and reclassify the state of Jammu and Kashmir. This highly contentious move would give the government in New Delhi more control over the disputed Muslim-majority region. The bill was passed by the lower house of parliament and will change Jammu and Kashmir's administrative status from a state to a union territory. In the Indian system, state governments retain significant authority over local matters, while union territories do not. In addition, the remote mountainous region of Ladakh, currently part of Jammu and Kashmir, will also be separated and turned into a standalone union territory. The region of Kashmir is claimed in its entirety by both India and Pakistan. It has been the epicenter for more than 70 years of an often violent territorial struggle between neighbors, both of which have nuclear capabilities. On Monday, Prime Minister Narendra Modi announced they are revoking Article 370 of the Constitution, which granted special status to the state of Jammu and Kashmir. This gave the region the power to have its own constitution, flag, and autonomy over all matters except foreign affairs and defense. The removal of Article 370 means Jammu and Kashmir will be governed under all the provisions of the Indian Constitution. This will allow non-residents to purchase property and apply for jobs or scholarships that were previously reserved for the state's residents. Experts say this could open the way for a steady demographic change in India's only Muslim-majority state. Revoking Kashmir's special status was one of the promises made by Modi's Hindu Nationalist Party ahead of recent elections. The bill will unilaterally alter the administration of Jammu and Kashmir without consultation from any state leaders. As a union territory, it will now be overseen by a New Delhi-appointed official. Experts worry that these changes could further inflame tensions in Kashmir and increase the risk of violence in an already unstable region.
An executive order from President Trump yesterday will freeze all public assets and business dealings with Venezuela, including all dealings with the country's central bank and state-run oil company, a move which could complicate already strained U.S. relations with Russia and China. In a conference held in Peru earlier today, U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton urged leaders to join the U.S. in escalating pressure on Venezuela, reminding the governments of the world that, with the new executive order in place, U.S. authorities can now target and sanction anyone, including foreign nationals, for their support of Nicolas Maduro's government in Venezuela. Sources estimate that the new sanctions will roughly triple the effects of the ones that have already forced more than 4 million Venezuelans to flee the oil-rich nation. In a statement released this morning, Russia's foreign ministry called the move illegal and described the sanctions as amounting to, quote, economic terror. The administration hopes that the new sanctions will cause enough suffering to finally force Venezuela's military to overthrow the current government and install one friendlier to U.S. interests.
There are over 40 million grassy acres in the continental U.S., and now many water providers are offering rebates to residents willing to tear out their lawns and replace them with drought-tolerant plants. Here's more from H2O Radio.
It's hard to avoid getting swept up in Wendy Inouye's enthusiasm when she talks about her garden.
I love it. I have so much joy from my garden. Every time I come out, I always pause and I look at it. You know that saying, take time to stop and smell the roses? I literally do that.
Inouye's front yard at her home in Thornton, Colorado, just north of Denver, is full of xeric plants, shrubs and ground covers adapted to survive in dry climates. Inouye took out most of her lawn last summer and replaced it with a Colorado-friendly landscape that includes hop flower oregano and a plant called red birds in a tree. She got help from the city of Thornton, which paid her $1 for each square foot of grass she removed. And by taking out 750 square feet of turf and replacing it with a variety of xeric plants surrounded by rocks and mulch, she and her husband have reduced their water usage from 413 gallons a day to 200.
This was just one big flat piece of grass that was full of weeds. And I didn't want to be buying herbicides and fertilizing. I felt like I was just fighting nature. I was done with that. And now I have fun with all these beautiful flowering plants. And those right there are red rock penstemons, and they're in full bloom. These are hop flower.
Water conservation, particularly in the U.S. West, is always important, and utilities have a variety of strategies they use to encourage people to use less. One such strategy is to give residents rebates for taking out their lawn.
Realistically, do you really need to be having that 1,500 square, you know, rectangle square in the front of your house that's grass that you're never using?
That's Bill McDonnell, who manages water efficiency programs at the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which serves 19 million water customers in many different cities, including Los Angeles and San Diego.
It's just a green square. You're mowing it, you're fertilizing it, so you're, you know, adding green waste. Just a lot going on there to have a green patch.
The district recently renewed its rebate program, increasing it to $2 per square foot, even though there's no drought. And they plan to keep the program going indefinitely.
Somewhere down the road, you're going to be, you know, my kids are going to be walking their kids or whatever, and they're going to say, look at that house. That's pretty weird. It has grass in the front.
In the Las Vegas area, the Southern Nevada Water Authority has offered cash for grass payments for nearly a decade. The program has resulted in so much turf being removed that if a standard width of sod were rolled out, it would stretch nearly around the world. But there are two major western cities that are not so fired up about turf rebates: Phoenix, Arizona, and Denver, Colorado. Cynthia Campbell, the Water Resource Management Advisor for Phoenix, said that using turf there has declined despite no rebate.
Back in 1978, in the 1970s, the city of Phoenix, as it existed then, which was certainly a smaller city than it is today, but at that time, about 80% of the single-family homes had majority turf landscaping. Today, that number is closer to 14%.
Nevertheless, Campbell adds,
the majority of water use is outside.
As much as 60 to 70%, she said. Because Denver gets more annual precipitation than Las Vegas or Southern California, and has winter when lawns don't get watered, removing grass would net less water savings. Denver Water, which doesn't offer turf replacement rebates, says they're not needed.
So we've actually seen a lot of the change in landscapes, and that's been led by our customers and been implemented and modeled throughout our service area.
Jeff Terrell is Denver's manager of water efficiency. And he attributes the shift to education programs Denver Water started in the 1980s. Denver Water did an analysis of a cash for grass rebate in 2016 and calculated the cost to be $75,000 per acre foot of water conserved. At that point, Terrell said, it didn't make sense to use ratepayers' funds on rebates. However, Denver Water may see lawns as more than attractive landscapes. They might be a sort of green cushion, a buffer against extreme drought. University of Colorado historian Patty Limerick wrote in her book about Denver water, A Ditch in Time, that to its former manager, the late Chips Berry, lawns looked a lot like a dispersed version of a reservoir, holding water that could be shifted to genuine need away from grass in urgent circumstances. In other words, it would be a lot easier to ask homeowners to let their lawns go brown than ask them to take shorter showers. But Terrell said that they have evolved from looking at turf in that way.
Chips was reflecting where we were.
Still, other cities near Denver like Thornton, Aurora, and Fort Collins all offer rebates. Drew Beckwith with the nearby city of Westminster says they plan to offer a rebate next year. He said that conservation through a cash for grass program and other incentives is cheaper, faster, and smarter than building dams, reservoirs, and pipelines. Back at Wendy Inouye's home in Thornton, she says transformation away from grass was a lot of work, but
the rewards are phenomenal.
So it's all worth it.
It is so worth it.
And are you happy that City of Thornton has a rebate program?
I am. I figure it took the edge off some of the costs. You get some support and you feel like the city is on the same mission as you are.
For H2O Radio in Denver, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 6, 2019. This has been a volunteer-produced newscast, and we always encourage your participation. Please call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and the engineer is Liam Delta. A podcast of this newscast is always available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Jacqueline Killer. At 9, The Politics of Living. At 10, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to KBOO.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. On Sunday, December 1st, 2018, hundreds of people attended the Poor People's Hearing on the Impact of Homelessness on All Women and Children. It was held at Skid Row in Los Angeles, California. Skid Row is a well-known community of unhoused people, many of whom have been organizing around housing justice and other issues. The event was jointly hosted by the California Poor People's Campaign and the Los Angeles Community Action Network, known as LA CAN. It is one of many in a series of poor people's hearings happening in other states around the country. The Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is a multiracial movement fighting what they say are the four pillars of evil: poverty, racism, a war economy, and environmental devastation. They say they also want to change the moral narrative. The Los Angeles Community Action Network is a community community-based organization in Skid Row that works in partnership with people who are living in poverty to build political power and hold elected officials accountable. According to the 2018 Greater Los Angeles Homeless Count, women and girls account for 31% of the nearly 53,000 homeless people in Los Angeles County. 9% of those experiencing homelessness are children, and these numbers, by the way, are conservative numbers. Women and their children are the fastest growing population among the homeless in Los Angeles County, as well as in other urban areas in the United States. And today, we hear directly from women and some quotes from children who were directly impacted by poverty and homelessness. They spoke at the December 1st event. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Trump plans to travel to El Paso, Texas tomorrow in the wake of Saturday's Walmart shooting, despite calls by some Democrats for him to stay away. The alleged shooter is being investigated as the likely author of a hate-filled anti-immigrant manifesto posted online shortly before the mass shooting, some of which mimicked Trump's denunciations of immigrants. Democratic presidential candidate and former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke told CNN he agrees with his former constituents who say Trump has no business coming to El Paso.
I was just talking to somebody, listening to a woman who came up and said hello to me, and she said, why is he coming here when he hates us? She's reflecting the fact that he described Mexican immigrants. This is a town of Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals, repeatedly has warned of an invasion, trying to make us afraid of those who do not look like the majority of this country. He's described human beings as an infestation, which you or I might describe cockroaches or termites, but not human beings.
The death toll in the El Paso shooting rose to 22 after two more victims succumbed to their injuries. Mexico's foreign minister traveled to El Paso to visit Mexican nationals wounded in the attack and to say Mexico will seek to participate in the case against the alleged shooter. Eight Mexicans died. Another six remain hospitalized. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca.
Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, offered condolences to the victims of the attack and said Mexico will seek to participate in the investigation through mechanisms available through international law and under binational security cooperation agreements.
Y será la primera carpeta de investigación de esta importancia en la historia de México sobre terrorismo.
Ebrard says it will mark the first time Mexico has sought to use the mechanism for a terrorism case in the U.S. The Mexican government has expressed specific interest in how the shooter acquired his rifle and if the sale involved irregularities, raised red flags, or was just business as usual north of the border. In his morning press conference, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said both major political parties in the U.S. have neglected to take substantive action on the issue of gun control.
Y vamos también siendo muy respetuosos a seguir insistiendo.
He said Mexico will continue to respectfully insist the U.S. do something about poorly regulated gun sales that allow mass shooters to easily acquire weapons. I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine is facing pressure to take action after the shooting outside a strip of nightclubs early Sunday morning in Dayton. He said he'll outline plans later today. Hundreds of people chanted at him, "Do something," while he spoke at a vigil for the nine people killed by the gunman with an AR-15-style rifle. Police have said 24-year-old Connor Betts was wearing a mask and body armor when he opened fire. If all the magazines he had with him were full, which hasn't been confirmed, he would have had a maximum of 250 rounds. Two former classmates have said the shooter was suspended during his junior year in high school after a hit list was found scrawled in a school bathroom. That followed an earlier suspension after he came to school with a list of female students he wanted to sexually assault. A former classmate said it's baffling and horrible that somebody who's been talking for 10 years about wanting to shoot people could so easily get access to a military-grade weapon and that much ammunition. India's lower house of parliament was set to ratify a bill downgrading self-rule in the Indian-administered portion of Muslim-majority Kashmir. India maintained an indefinite security lockdown in the Himalayan region and a cutoff of internet, cell phone, and landline networks. It deployed thousands of troops. The territory has been a flashpoint between nuclear-armed rivals India and Pakistan. Pakistan's president convened his country's parliament to discuss India's surprise action. The country's top military commanders were meeting in the garrison city of Rawalpindi. The foreign minister appealed to the United Nations to send a fact-finding mission. China allowed its currency, the yuan, to fall farther against the U.S. dollar before strengthening a bit later in the day. The maneuvers came amid fears about mounting economic damage from President Trump's trade war with China. The Trump administration responded by officially declaring that China was engaged in currency manipulation. That opens the way to possible new penalties on top of existing U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods.
Those were our news headlines. And now we hear testimony from those directly impacted, women directly impacted from the Poor People's Hearing on the Impact of Homelessness on All Women and Children held on December 1st. It was an event jointly organized by the Los Angeles Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, as well as the Los Angeles Community Action Network. It was held in Skid Row in Los Angeles, California.
50 years ago, no one thought that we would be sitting here still fighting for the right and the dignity for each and every person in this room. Regardless of your race, regardless of where you come from, regardless of your social class, we believe that America has a heart problem. And we are the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. The scripture says in Psalms 42 and 7 that deep calls out to deep. And in this space today, what we will hear, what we will feel, what we are experiencing together is the deep pain, the deep suffering, the diminishing of the divine in each and every one of us by systems of oppression who says that we don't deserve to live. We don't deserve to raise our children. We don't deserve to have a good food on the table. But we are here today to say that somebody's been hurting our brothers and sisters, our mothers and children far too long, and we will not be silent anymore. So in this space, you are seen. In this space, you are heard. In this space, let your deep, your pain, your joy, call out to the deep of everyone in this room, and may we hold it together. And at the end of the day, may we leave saying, I see you, and I will fight with you, because you and I are weaved together in a fabric of inescapable mutuality. So let us sit in our deepness on this afternoon.
Amen. 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 Please join with me in prayer. Oh God, we often call you Father, but you are also our mother. Our mother who births new life, our mother who fights for her children, our mother who provides for her children, every single one of them. Our mother who loves her children and walks with her children. We call upon you today because we need to get back on our knees and ask for forgiveness. It has been 50 years. It has been even longer for all of us. And we are still here. We are still fighting. We ask for forgiveness because there are 134,000 people in our state who do not have a home. We have 52,000 in LA County alone who have no place to rest their head. And 73% of those, O God, of the poor are women and children. We have failed you, O God, and we ask for forgiveness. We have failed each other, O God, and we ask for forgiveness. We have failed our mothers and our children. O Lord, our Christian Advent season starts tomorrow, and we are reminded that when Mary was with child, she knocked on the door. She knocked and she knocked from door to door, but there was no room at the inn. There was no room for Mary and her baby to find safe haven, to find a bed, to lay their heads. Today, Mother God, we ask for your forgiveness, because when our people knocked, when our mothers knocked, when our mothers went from door to door, there was no room at the end. No room for our bed, no room to lay their heads, no room for their babies. God, we have failed you and we have failed each other. You have created this world so that we have enough, but we have become greedy and we have forgotten who we are. Open our ears, open our eyes, open our hearts to listen today to the cries of our mothers and our babes so that we can say no more. Open our doors at the inn to all who knock.
So many people across the nation are looking for this type of inspiration. And I just want to say, LA, you're giving it to not only the nation, but the world, by showing up and saying that we all count. So today we're standing in the shadows of 25 residents of downtown Los Angeles who got together in 1999 and realized that they had all very common problems. And they made a commitment to each other to stand together and to organize and become a force in the community that demands change. So with that agreement, the mission of LA Can was founded and developed. Our mission is quite simply this: to organize and empower community residents to work collectively to change the relationships of power that affect our community.
21.4 million people in the state of California who can't afford or is one paycheck away from living on the streets.
And when it comes to systemic racism in relationship to poverty, there are 130,390 people impoverished. Over 78% of those folks are people of color. Black residents are incarcerated almost 9 times the rate of white residents.
In LA County alone, the African American population is 8% of the population, but it's over 30% of the prison population and over 40% of the homeless population or the people experiencing houselessness.
When it comes to militarism and the war economy, from 2008 to 2004, law enforcement has received $152.3 million in military upgrade in equipment.
$6.4 million workers in California make under $15 an hour. We believe in the Poor People's Campaign that everybody has a right to live, which means that everybody has a right not just to a fair wage, but a living wage. So we want $15 an hour, but we want more than $15 an hour to make sure everybody has a fair and living wage. It's okay, you can clap to that.
So in California, when it comes to ecological devastation and health, 3 million people are uninsured in California. 18.7% of the census tract in California are at risk of being vulnerable and unable to afford water. Is water a human right? Yes.
In California, when we fight racism, we're talking about voter suppression. I know you watched the news and you saw the voter suppression happening in Florida and Georgia and in Mississippi. But did you know that in LA, 118,000 votes was lost in the last election cycle? Do you know that the mobile voting booth has caused so many of people who are experiencing houselessness to become disenfranchised and take away their right to vote? We believe in this campaign that all of us deserve the right to have our voice heard. All of us deserve our dignity. All of us deserve food. All of us deserve a living wage. All of us deserve equal access to housing. And so today, we are here to hear the testimonies of those who are most impacted by the pain, to hear and to listen deeply, and then to go and do something about it. Amen?
Amen. Good afternoon, everybody. Can you hear okay? I'm Sydney with Every Mother is a Working Mother Network, and I'm reading a statement from that way? Okay. Sorry. I'm here reading a statement from Kathy Klein, who hoped to be here today and has not been able to get here. Okay. My name is Kathy Klein. I'm a mother with a disability, and I want to share my experience being homeless and dealing with the child welfare system. I was sick, hospitalized, and unable to pay my rent and became homeless. My 13-year-old son and I had nowhere to live. So we went to the downtown shelter for women and asked for assistance. They sent us to LA Department of Children and Family Services, DCFS. DCFS placed us with a church in Oxnard. I was sent to the women's home and my son to the youth home. We only saw each other on Sundays after church. I was given the job to watch the small children while their mothers were sent by this church to sell candy from 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. You had to sell candy to be able to stay, and the church used the funds raised to pay their mortgage. One day, they sent me to join in selling candy. I went alone and took a bus back to LA. I went back to the DCFS social worker to get help to bring my son back to live with me in LA. All I needed was bus fare to get back to Oxnard to get my son. But DCFS never offered me any help. So the police went and got my son. And as I didn't have funds to go get him, the police called Child Protective Services, who put my child in foster care. And I found myself in the child welfare system. Ventura County Child Protective Services also didn't offer any assistance to keep me and my son together. They told me I had to get myself back on my own 2 feet. So I decided to return to LA. I finally received help at Adult Union Station in Pasadena, got housing so that I could try and get my son back. But even having a 2-bedroom apartment wasn't enough. Ventura County Child Protective Services accused me of neglect and would not return my child to me. As a result, my son was kept in foster care in Oxnard until he graduated from high school. 4 years of going back and forth to Children's Court in Ventura County for nothing, though I had no prior history of abuse or criminal activity. Why are resources found to pay for Children's Court and foster care, but not to keep families together? Why are there trillions for war, but money can't be found for welfare, or to help mothers and children, or vets either, to keep a roof over our heads? I was glad that, despite this system setting up for you to fail, I was able to get myself back together and be reunited with my son when he turned 18 and aged out of the child welfare system. But no mother should ever have to go through being separated from her children because they become homeless. Working together with others, who had experiences like mine has helped to give me strength. And that's why we need a Poor People's Campaign. We need to stick together and fight this through.
So we're out of time. Today's show produced by me. That's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Ramiro Funes and production intern Julianne Twinton. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at So True Radio. Thank you so much for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland. Next up is Transpositive PDX with Nicolette and Emma.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Feminist Film